You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Monday, November 26, 2012. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, Clean Break, the story of Germany's energy transformation and what Americans can learn from it, by Osha Gray Davidson, will join us on the, well, I guess in the wake of our interview with the director of Chasing Ice, in the wake of the announcement that we have hit new levels of carbon dioxide in 2011, knowing that we're just a week or so away from treaty meetings in Qatar, looking to set new standards, new climate change targets, unlikely. Also on the program today, the Walmart Black Friday strikes a success. 1,000 of them took place across the country, or at least protests. A Norquist rebellion? Nah, not so much. As the fiscal cliff, fiscal slope, austerity bomb negotiations continue, will they make a deal before January 1st? We'll find out. Good news, militia groups growing exponentially in this country. And sadly, of course, we now have a war on men brewing over at Fox. And in Egypt, more protests as the secular and religious left, I guess you could call them. I don't know if you called the religious left, but those who were part of the coalition protesting against the late Egyptian regime have split apart in reaction to Morsi, the new Egyptian president's proclamations. I guess it was towards the end of last week, where he basically said, president, king, let's not, you say president, I say king, it doesn't matter. Pharaoh. That's basically it. We will get into that in just a moment. But folks, before we take a break and talk to Osha Gray Davidson, I know you all went home for Thanksgiving. You met with your family. Maybe you had some arguments. Maybe you sat your father down and said, "Dad, well, you would have done this if you were one of the Trump children," according to New York Daily News. Eric Donald Jr. and Ivanka apparently sat Donald down. Now, they did this at his office because they probably don't have Thanksgiving together. I don't know. Maybe they do. They don't. I have no idea. The family structure over there seems a little strange. But they basically sat him down and said, "Dad, please, please, you're acting like a douche. You're embarrassing us." The Twitter stuff with President Obama and then going on about his birth certificate, It's embarrassing, and it's starting to hurt business. According to a source in the Daily News, the three of them met and went to see their dad in his Fifth Avenue office. They showed a lot of respect, but told him he's worked too long and too hard to build up the reputation he has. They understand completely he's always been outspoken, that he likes attention, but this is too much. You got to love the fact that when the three kids go and talk to dad, it gets reported in the Daily News. You know, so we all had our experiences telling our parents to please stop acting like a jerk, or just stop worrying about the gravy or whatever. Nobody cares about that fourth stuffing of chicken. You know, let's just have fun. And but at the Trump household, apparently, it becomes news. So I got to say, though, if you're doing this Obama intervention, essentially, with your dad, this intervention has come far, far too late, I think, for the Trump family. I think probably they should have done this about 4 or 5 years ago.
It wouldn't surprise me if Donald Trump was the one who leaked the story. I need more attention. Tell the Daily News that my kids...
How can I leverage this? I've been scolded by my kids. Let me see if I can leverage this for a couple of ratings points for the next season of The Apprentice. All right, folks, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Osha Gray Davidson.
Make a hole with a gun perpendicular to the name of this town in a desktop globe. Exit wound in a foreign nation, showing the home of the one this was written for. My apartment looks upside down from there. Water spirals the wrong way out the sink. And her voice is a backwards record. It's like a in the glow of each other's majestic presence. Listen in and hear my words to the ones you would think I would say if there was a meeting.
We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program Osha Gray Davidson. He is the author of Clean Break, the story of Germany's energy transformation and what Americans can learn from it. And he is also the publisher of thephoenixsun.com. Welcome to the program, Osha.
Thanks very much, Sam. Glad to be here.
All right, so let's start with the story of Germany's transformation in 2000. Now we're talking 12 years ago. 6% of Germany's energy came from renewable sources. What has happened since then?
Well, what's happened is today they're at 26%. So they went from 6 to 26% renewables in just 12 years, which is more than what their target was. They've been ahead of their target all the way, and now so much so that in 2020, they were supposed to be, they planned on being at 30%, and now they've moved that up to 35%. So they're well on their way.
Okay, and so this started essentially with, well, I don't know if it started with a piece of legislation, but that was the, I guess, the catalyst for this transformation in Germany.
Well, there's a number of ways you can look at it, and that's certainly one, because if you look at a legislative history, go back to 2000, and that's when the Renewable Energy Act was passed. But if you look a bit deeper into what created that, what caused that to happen, it was a citizens' movement that started, and even that you can go back further, but 1986, after Chernobyl, there was a movement of people in small villages all throughout Germany and in cities of people who didn't want the risk anymore of nuclear power, because after Chernobyl, when radioactivity fell across Germany, people just didn't want to deal with that. They realized it was too big of a risk for them. And people just started putting up renewable power themselves. And there were a number of battles, and I chronicle some of that in the book. But what eventually happened is politicians gave the people what they wanted, which was a phase out of nuclear power eventually, and a program of feed-in tariffs, a way of supporting renewable energy. And that's really made a huge difference.
Yeah, explain to us what are feed-in tariffs?
Okay, so without getting into too many details here, essentially, although they've been called subsidies, they're not paid for by the government. What happens is if you want to put solar panels on your roof, you just do. You put solar panels on your roof, and then whatever year, if you do it this year, say, and you will be guaranteed for the next 20 years a price above the market price now in payment for every watt that you produce, that you send onto the grid. So that's good for 20 years, which gave the business community and everybody, since everybody can now become a utility in Germany, that gave them the stability that they needed to be able to figure out if this is cost effective. And by doing that, they made sure that everybody had skin in the game. And that kind of enticement worked to the point where now 65% of all renewable energy in Germany is generated by individuals, co-ops, or small groups of investors.
And how do they provide that? I mean, how do they provide that that price point?
Where do they get the money?
Yeah,
it's paid by ratepayers, and it comes on their utility bill. It's spread throughout Germany. Regular ratepayers pay a certain amount to make this transition to renewable energy every year. And it has had broad support throughout Germany for a number of years. One problem with it, and there are a lot of problems to this transition. It's not an easy thing to do, but they're doing it. One problem is that certain groups are exempted from paying that tax, which means, or not tax, that amount. So other people, normal ratepayers and small businesses, have to pay even more. And that's where it becomes a contentious issue now, because so many high energy, high electricity users, large corporations, large manufacturers, don't have to pay anything into this renewable energy payment plan. And they're getting another benefit from it, because the amount of renewables that have entered into the grid, the electricity that's entered into the grid, has pushed down the price of the wholesale price of electricity by about 18%.
And now, is that the pushing down of the price of electricity, that is that savings, does that in some way offset that fee that the sort of normal consumer pays in some respects,
well,
or no?
It certainly does to some extent. But this is a long-term project. And one thing that people fail to take into account, it's very different when you build a nuclear plant or a coal-generated electricity plant. When you do that, once you paid back that initial investment, you still have to pay for fuel forever, and that price is going up for coal, for natural gas in Germany in particular. It's gone down in the U.S. But with renewables, there's no cost involved for the actual source, the renewable energy source. It's wind, it's solar, sunshine, it's hydropower. So it's going to become cheaper and cheaper. Also, that subsidy, or sorry, here I am calling it a subsidy now, but that renewable energy surcharge that's put on a bill, that goes down. The amount that you receive every year for putting solar on your roof or whatever, that amount goes down every year, which does two things. It gets people to invest as soon as possible in putting up solar panels or joining together with friends to invest in a wind farm. And it also eventually it lowers the price of the electricity.
And it goes down, but it goes down in a predictable – we know exactly what it's going to be in 2015. We know it's going to be in 2017, et cetera.
There's certainly a lot more – there's more certainty involved when you're dealing with renewables, because you don't have the source of the energy. You don't have that price going up, whereas with coal, with oil, with natural gas – there's really no way to know exactly what's going to happen, and that's why we've had oil shocks in the past. as resources dwindle, it gets more expensive to get them out of the ground. And that doesn't take into account any of the health effects or climate change effects of using the traditional sources of fuel, fossil fuels, where there aren't any of those effects, obviously, with wind and solar.
Now, the Renewable Energy Act, it calls for 80% renewable power by 2050 in Germany. Do they seem like they're on their goal? I mean, I would imagine at one point it becomes each percentage point in which you are increasing the amount of renewable energy comes a little bit less easy, and or at one point it becomes harder to make
right.
that transition. Give me a sense of what that trajectory looks like.
Well, right now they're still beating their trajectory of what they had planned. But you're right that once you get past, say, 40%, it's going to get a lot tougher. For one thing, you're going to need storage to be able to store the electricity generated by renewables that you don't need at this point. But once you get up to 40%, engineers in Germany have said that that's when they'll really need to have storage. And there are other solutions to it, too, and Germany's pursuing them, of having a European-wide grid, where, or like they do in Scandinavia, where the grid itself crosses national boundaries with ease, and so Germany has to work on that, and that's a tall order. But the Germans I talked to, most of them are pretty certain that they can do this, in part because they were told when they first wanted to make this renewable energy transition, a lot of people in Germany, engineers there, said, no, you can't do that, because after you get past 4%, the grid won't be able to handle it. Well, now they're at 26% and they're handling it. So they feel confident that they can continue to meet the challenges and stay on target to meet that goal.
Some
actually believe they can do better than the 80%.
What is it about at 40% once you get there that you need to start to store it? Is because the amount of energy that's being put out there is not being used in the moment at that point?
Exactly. That's my understanding of it, that at 40%, you've got such a significant portion of the grid dependent on it that there are times that you're producing more electricity than is being used. And right now, that has happened. A few days this past summer, that they actually had more renewable energy than they knew what to do with, so they had to sell it at a loss in some cases, I believe, or certainly for very cheap. The utilities had to sell their excess capacity to other countries.
Because they didn't have an efficient way of just storing it for later, essentially.
Right. Batteries are expensive. They do have some really innovative ideas that they're pursuing, as well as cheaper batteries in Germany, like gravity-fed systems, where you use excess power during the day to pump water uphill to large holding ponds or lakes, and then when you need it more later, you can have it come down and power turbines. Mm. So there are a number of possibilities of what to do, but they're pursuing all of these, and you know, they've done what was considered impossible already. Whether they'll be able to continue to do that certainly looks like they'll be able to, but it's not assured, and it's not easy. But they're certainly doing a much better job than we are.
So, I mean, aside from the political question, which I want to get to in terms of, you know, if there are any lessons there for the United States, and But in terms of the way that energy is delivered, it seems that the primary difference was having, I guess, energy sort of like a distributed system where you have just a bunch of individual energy producers, as opposed to who could, rather than just sort of roll back their own usage on their meter, could actually in some ways perhaps profit from it.
Absolutely. And a lot of the people I talked to, the experts in Germany, I spent 3 weeks traveling there, seeing projects and interviewing people, and a lot of them made that point that that the key to the energy revolution, or the German word for it is Energiewende, the key to that is having decentralized distributed power. And that's key for a number of reasons. And one is that you have the benefits accruing across the board to people. And so it pushes an entrepreneurial plan. So people can take advantage of this. They want it. They can benefit from it. It's not just a feel-good program of having a utility put up solar panels and you know that, okay, so some slight difference in climate, in greenhouse emissions are being made. People also actually make money doing this in Germany because the benefits are widespread. And that's entirely due to having a feed-in tariff where you allow everybody to become a utility instead of having a monopoly of just a few.
All right, so let's extrapolate these things to the United States for a moment. Okay, so it seems to me the biggest obstacle because from a physics standpoint, it doesn't appear that there is anything about the nature of Germany as, you know, physically that we would have to change much to bring this program to the United States. I mean, is there maybe more density? I don't know. What is there any difference in terms of like the actual physicality?
I get what you're saying, and there are differences, but they can be met according to the National Renewable Energy Laboratory, the government laboratory that deals with renewable power in the United States. They produced a study that found that by the year 2050, the U.S. can get, there's no physical reason why we can get 80% of our power from renewables. And what do you know, that's exactly what Germany's plan is. So they found that it would work here. And that doesn't mean that there aren't obstacles. And some of them are the same as Germany faced, and some of them are different. But yeah, it can be done physically, according to them.
What would be some of the physical obstacles that we would face that Germany didn't? I mean, I would imagine if we look at it as a distributed system, that would mitigate a lot of the sort of the physical issues. Yes, and I imagine, I mean, Germany has no more or less sun than I would imagine the average place in the United States. I mean, I think they have the amount of sun that is it.
Alaska.
Yeah, Alaska. I mean, so what type of physical impediments would we be subject to that the Germans weren't?
I can't speak to that with any expertise. I can tell you what I know of it is what I've heard mostly is just that the distances involved are so large, and that with a giant city, it's very difficult to get enough renewable power to power it. There are more people living in rural areas and small towns in Germany. So the U.S. would face more problems with that, also with building a grid, which we need to do anyway because ours is old and decrepit.
Right.
But that's a lot. Again, that gets back to capital costs. None of this is really a physical hurdle. All of them get back to the amount of money that needs to be spent and the political will to do it. And that's where there's the difference between the United States and Germany. They're willing to pay for it, and there's political will to do it.
And let's talk about the political opposition to it, because I would imagine that Germany did not have the sort of institutional opposition to allowing individual Germans to have more control over their energy production than we see in this country, because we have huge fossil fuel interests, huge coal interests, huge nuclear interests. It seems to me that it's that type of obstacle which Germany didn't face in the same way that we did. But maybe I'm wrong. You tell me.
Well, that's a great question. I got mixed answers on that. Some of the experts I talked to in Germany said, well, look, we faced the same problems that you did. We had an enormous nuclear complex here of industry. And that certainly is true. But in Germany, very early, people started getting on board with this, in part because it grew out of opposition to nuclear power that was so strong in Germany that people wanted to end nuclear power, and the anti-nuke people in Germany looked around and said, you know, we can't just say no. People can't just say no to things. We have to find a way of saying yes to something. Can't get rid of nuclear power. You have to do something else. And they realized that renewable power will be able to have, is a way to close down, I'm sorry, that renewable power is a way to close down nuclear power. That's aside from all the other benefits of climate change and income that's now spread out through small towns and everything in Germany. So that's just one thing.
How big was nuclear power in Germany at that time when that movement started? I mean, in other words, how much did Germany get its was it powered by nukes?
I might be wrong on this, but I think it was about 30% at that time. And now it's down beyond, I think it's 18%, something like that, that they've lowered it. So it was a significant share, and they did face opposition. I did talk to other people who said they believe that the whole difference between the United States and Germany, almost all of it, can be attributed to what you're talking about, the political influence in the United States of the opponents. Also, you have to remember that they have a different system of government there with it's a parliamentary system, so that allows smaller groups of people. It's a multi-party system. It's harder to capture politicians in Germany than in the United States with campaign contributions by large corporations. So that, you know, I think there's a lot of substance in that, but I really don't know which. Maybe there's probably truth in both of those interpretations of what the reason is that we haven't been able to do it here.
Politically speaking, were there any particular parties that in that mix that were key? I mean, were the Greens big in pushing that legislation and building the coalitions necessary? I'm just curious from a...
Absolutely.
Tell us about that.
It was called the Green-Red Coalition, the Green Party and the Social Democrat. And they formed a coalition government and were in charge of the government for several years in the early 2000s. But it's interesting. That was one of the things that I learned a lot about while I was there and before I left, that the party system is different there. I mean, the CDU, which is the center-right leading coalition partner in Germany that Angela Merkel is the head of, and she's the chancellor of Germany, they're... If she were in the U.S., she would probably be on the political spectrum, she'd probably fall in the moderate Republican side, of which we have almost none in the United States.
I was going to say, so the Democratic Party.
The right wing of the Democratic Party.
Okay.
Yes, that's probably a good way to see it. Now, she has not implemented the Energiewende as efficiently as the earlier party coalition, ruling coalition, did. And a lot of the problems that have cropped up, some people in Germany, experts, say, well, that's because you have people who aren't 100% behind this, who are the governing coalition. And so that, I think that is a big factor.
And so the it will require the same degree of political will throughout the process. So I mean, with the lessons that you have learned from studying how this happened in Germany, what are some of the keys for this to happen in the United States? Because it seems to me the big issue is how do you get to a point where we have the ability. Particularly, I would imagine in there are certain areas where it's far more efficient and far more crucial to have decentralized little essentially power I don't know, power stations, power plants, if you will. And by that, I mean, you know, maybe a couple of panels for a neighborhood or something.
Well, it's interesting. The Institute for Local Self-Reliance in Minnesota did a study a few years ago that found that I think it was every state but maybe three or four could be could use this distributed model to get all of their electricity. It would they'd use different technologies in different areas, obviously. In Iowa, they already get, I don't know, a third, something like that, of their electricity from wind power. And down here in Arizona where I live, we could be getting a huge amount from solar, and we're not really taking advantage of it, although the growth has been quite exceptional here in Arizona in the past year or so. But that model can mostly work throughout the United States. But the key is, and I think this is the main factor that you're looking for and talking about, is that in Germany, it started from the bottom up. They didn't wait for politicians to do this Renewable Energy Act. It was politicians reacting to groups and individuals throughout the country who were demanding that they have this switch. They didn't want to live in fear of nuclear power anymore. They also didn't want to pay the they didn't like the monopoly status that the nuclear power plants had and the coal plants. So I think for it to happen in the United States, we can talk about politicians being bought out, and you know, I brought that up myself, but at really the crucial point is there has to be citizens' movement, and thankfully there already is. There are people around the country who are building renewables, who are creating programs, and it's difficult to do. But there are feed-in tariffs that have some of the same qualities and are somewhat different. So it is starting in the United States. It isn't reported on adequately, I don't think, but we're, you know, a decade or more behind where Germany was, and there's a lot that could be done through legislation at the state and the federal level to make this transition. But, you know, are we willing to do that? Are people willing to do this?
I mean, it seems that we unfortunately don't have that sort of that inciting event of Chernobyl, because to the extent that we are sort of slowly I mean, on one hand, when you're talking about burning fossil fuels, it is a less immediate, or at least it appears to be a less immediate threat to our health and safety than the idea of radioactivity showering upon us, I would imagine, on some level.
Yeah. That's certainly true, and I would hope we wouldn't need something like that to happen here to get us to change. But we already we have climate change that's increasing the sea level here, leading to flooding, drought. I mean, there are tremendous costs already. People have done opponents of renewable energy have done a pretty good job of saying that there is no problem with climate change. We also have 13,000 people a year die in the United States prematurely from breathing pollutants from coal-fired electrical plants, which is just, I guess, assumed that that's just an acceptable price. But we don't need that. And I think that there's a growing consensus now with climate change after Sandy and some other things, and the organizing around the Keystone XL pipeline from Canada for the shale oil, that no, this is a big threat. Climate change is a huge threat, and we need to find an alternative. And we do have those alternatives, and it's a matter of implementing programs that will allow people to take advantage of them.
You mentioned that there's been not very good reporting on what's been happening in terms of distributed power in this country. If there was one or two things that we should take a look at that my audience who wants to dig into this further would want to take a look at, what would you recommend?
I would actually recommend going to look at people who are experts in that area. I'm researching it now for a possible second book looking at it. But there are people who've been doing that all along. And the Institute for Local Self-Reliance, they have a website. John Farrell is their research director, I believe. And they have a number of studies, as does, you can look at Paul Gipe, G-I-P-E, online. He's done some studies. He's a wind proponent in particular. And following the publisher for my book that sent me to Germany is Inside Climate News, and they're online, and they do a good job of reporting on these things. So I'd recommend those.
Great. Well, the book is Clean Break. It is available for it's a buck on Amazon.
That's right.
It is the story of Germany's energy transformation and what Americans can learn from it. Osha Gray Davidson, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Sam.
All right, folks. We'll do one quick story. You know, the one question I wanted to ask him, which we didn't have a chance to get to, was why Angela Merkel? Why not Angela Merkel? Every time she comes up, that's always the question I wanted to know. Well, this is good news, folks. If you're in the business of, if you're concerned about the economy and you happen to be in the business of selling militia gear, according to the Southern Law Poverty Center, back in 2008, there were only 149 militia groups nationwide. But fortunately, over the past 5 years, four and a half now, we have seen a rise of over 1,100 militia groups. We are now at 1,274 militia groups in this country. WSOC-TV Charlotte, North Carolina, has a really heartwarming story about the Freedom Warriors National Militia down in Hickory, North Carolina. It's a national militia with apparently 15 members, commanded by Commander James Kendrick and his wife, Trin. Some of their friends. Apparently, they wear uniforms. And according to the commander, our rules are more strict than the U.S. military's rules as far as being highly professional at all times, 24/7, highly professional. That includes his wife calling him Commander Kendrick instead of his first name. It appears that none of these members of this militia have actually served in the military. But they are ready. If we are ever called on, then yes, we will step up to the plate and asking if they're prepared to fight to defend the nation. We have no problem. The only time I see that happening is if we are attacked by a foreign entity. So there you go. They wear a uniform. Not sure what the uniform is. Apparently, they spend much of their time, though, however, helping the local community. From volunteering at a local soup kitchen to helping families who are dealing with hardships. So that's not bad. Kendrick says the members meet every week at his apartment at Hillside Gardens. The complex receives government assistance through the Hickory Housing Authority. He is disabled and gets assistance, but wanted to live there, hoping the group could have a positive impact on low-income neighborhood. Someone else in that neighborhood said, I think it's just for show, because if they're trying to cut crime down, the police wouldn't be called as much. They're not helping us out none. They're just wearing the clothes, said Hickory resident Marisha Covington. Kendrick says he's a new breed of militias. We're the militia that actually steps up. So there you go, folks. New militias on the rise. We're going to take a break in the better half of the program. An update on what's happening in Egypt. Here is a little quiz for you. And I will turn on my IM machine so people can respond. I know some of the IMers will already know this because that's just the way they are. But here's a little quiz for you. In what three-year period since World War II has the deficit shrunk the most, ladies and gentlemen? In what three-year period, going all the way back to World War II, has the deficit shrunk the most? And what's the second fastest shrinking of the deficit? What period? That's a little quiz for the better half of the program. We'll also talk about what went on at Walmart this past week. The so-called Norquist Rebellion, not really a story, but it is part of the corporate media and the Petersonites trying to set you up to cut Social Security and Medicare. And you'll also be pleased to know that the tax rates for the wealthiest Americans fell again in 2010. The effective tax rates. Yes, they're paying even less taxes than you thought they thought that you thought they were. Number 646-257-3920. We will take a break and be back. Folks, I know we're a little bit behind on some of the pay issues that people have had. We will get to that. We apologize. Things have been a little bit hectic. But if you have not become a member of this program yet, now is the time to do it. We really need your support. Particularly, I get in a panic mode as we've got to re-sign the lease. They're upping the rent. I'm in a mild state of panic. More on my panic as in the coming weeks. But please, if you can afford to become a member, please do so today at majority.fm. If you want to be a member and can't afford to be a member, send me an email at majorityreporters@gmail.com. We will work something out. Other ways of supporting the show, of course, our Amazon link. If you're buying crap through Amazon, if you do that sort of thing, some of you do, some of you don't. If you do, easy way to support the show by doing nothing. Do you drink coffee? Do you go to Starbucks or some other fancy place? Well, then you should definitely be buying coffee from justcoffee.coop. Get a 10% discount, the coupon code MAJORITY. You can get the Majority Report blend or any other great fair trade coffee. They got organic coffee. They got tea. It's delicious. It is probably the most guilt-free purchase of anything that you can make. I really do think that's the case. I don't know. I haven't come up with anything else. Take our survey. We've got a link in the blog post today. We'll put up an ad for it on the site, too. As soon as I get off my lazy butt. All right, folks, see you in the better half.